its life sentence. 2 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr., and 3 days before Robert F. Kennedy was killed, an icon of a different sort was shot dead, at least briefly. Valerie Solanas, a feminist author and schizophrenic, slipped into Andy Warhol's studio and fired her gun 3 times. The first 2 shots missed, but the third hit its target. Warhol was on the phone with one of his performers, who mistook the sound of gunfire for a Velvet Underground-era whip being cracked inside the factory. At 4:51 p.m., doctors declared Andy Warhol dead. 1.5 minutes later, he came back. "Since I was shot, everything is such a dream to me," Andy Warhol told the New York Times in November. "I don't know what anything is about. Like, I don't even know whether or not I'm really alive, or whether I died. It's sad." As Warhol convalesced, Jonas Mekas, the 44-year-old Lithuanian-born New Yorker, found himself the de facto spokesman for the experimental film world. Headlines like "Underground Movies Get Public Acceptance" appeared in major periodicals throughout the year, and every story had a quote from Mekas. Over at WGBH, What's Happening, Mr. Silver showed Mekas's notes from the circus, with a soundtrack by Jim Kweskin's Jug Band, in its entirety. This episode of the show explored the idea of what an experimental film was, exactly, which was kind of like defining a word using that word. Despite the failure of Mel Lyman and George Pepper to create a successful Boston filmmaker Cinematheque, Mekas was happy to see his friends find popularity and controversy with Avatar, to which he occasionally contributed. In one piece he wrote, "Don't criticize. If you think you don't like something, don't write about it. Try to write only about what you like in a movie. Write only about those movies which you like, why you like them. Remember that when you are criticizing, you may be criticizing God. So think twice. See if you can separate man's work from God's work." Wondering how he might have felt about his old friend Mel actually declaring himself God, I visit Jonas Mekas in Brooklyn, where his loft holds a flood of books, films, posters, and ephemera. There seems to be no delineation between his living quarters and his archives. In private, when Mel didn't have to sing or play loud, he was very low. You could barely hear him. But it was incredible, the 92-year-old Mekas says, his accent still strong. "Quite incredible. I just cannot compare to anybody." Mekas gives me a DVD of his film In Between, a collection of sequences that didn't find a place in Walden. A diary film that's like a who's who of the New York avant-garde of the 1960s. It ends with a long shot of Mel Lyman playing banjo on a Manhattan rooftop as the sun rises. The bewitching music somehow invokes Americana while utilizing a Middle Eastern scale. Between footage of Salvador Dali and Allen Ginsberg, there's a snippet from the time Lyman lived with Mekas in the mid-60s. Mel, God Makes Coffee, reads the title card. It was one of those long, hot, slow summer days, Mekas recalls. Mel brought some coffee beans, but we had no coffee pot. So he collected all kinds of parts and dishes, and Mel put a perfect coffee pot together. We never had better coffee. Around the time of the coffee miracle in 1966, Mekas watched Mel write an entire book in one sitting, which he modestly titled Autobiography of a World Savior. Mekas decided to publish it. Mel was a nice guy, so I said, why not? The same year, in an issue of Film Culture, there's a listing for a full evening show of light, images, voice, human presence available to be booked, created by Mel Lyman and Jonas Mekas. The mind is a beautiful instrument when it is played with love. when it is used to reveal, to help, to bring together that which has been separated, Lyman wrote, introducing his signature all-caps emphasis mode of writing. Autobiography is what converted future Crawdaddy founder Paul Williams to the Church of Mel, even though Lyman would later describe the book as an elaborate put-on to amuse his Scientologist friends. I never understood this admiration where everyone was looking at Mel in awe when he said, "I'm God," Mikus says. He always said it with a smile, like a joke, but everyone else took it like a gospel. He did not look at life and universe and God with such seriousness. He thought it was all closer to the laughing Buddha. You can see from my footage of him, as little as I have, this idea of this puritanic seriousness. He did not believe in that type of God. In the spring of 1968, Mikus lectured at Boston College, a gig he used as an excuse to visit his old friend's commune in Roxbury. To him it resembled a little village, with no strangers or tourists around, and marijuana plants growing right outside the door. He filmed the plants, and the members, too. I got one shot of all of them, the whole family in one room like a family portrait. It was not that they were afraid of Mel, they were obsessed with him. It's then that Mikus confirms a legend about the Fort Hill community, a basement of one house known as the Vault, where they put members of the community who had misbehaved. They had their own laws, and if someone did something really nasty, they had their own prison. Mel showed it to me. He gave me a tour, and they had their own prison for punishment. They were in some ways strict with regulations they had to follow. There was something very old-fashioned about them, not very modern. But you felt good being there. Mikus doesn't find the idea of his friend running a private basement prison completely beyond the pale. Instead of turning to the police, they solved their own problems, he says, adding, "I don't think he was capable of doing wrong. Whatever happened that was wrong must have come from the people around him. They went overboard in whatever they were doing." Mel had a new multimedia vision in 1968, something he named the Magic Theater, a potential two-story complex with a screening area, recording studio, and film lab, and instructed the community to start building it behind 5 Fort Avenue Terrace. George Pepper described the plan's crown jewel, the cockpit, a small command station just big enough for Mel, where he could run the films, the music, the lights, everything at once. Around this time, Don West, an assistant to a vice president at CBS, became enchanted by the Fort Hill community. He began working on a pilot about the family, presciently entitled The Real World. "I just fell in love with the Hill," he said. "And I thought, they with me. They thought I was the route to taking over CBS. I suspended most of my critical judgment and just let it happen, if you know what I mean." West worked closely with Pepper until he was finally granted an audience with Lyman, who screened for him some of his recent work. One documented all of the community's children waking up in the morning. Another captured Jim Queskin in the middle of an acid trip. Avatar writer Charles Giuliano, who appears in the Rolling Stone piece under the pseudonym Harry Bikes, speaks about a private film screening he attended on Fort Hill one night in 1968. "I can remember one of the movies that I saw there was of a woman that was pregnant. Mel fed her a hallucinogen and filmed her. And I look at this and, I mean, here she is pregnant and she's high and hallucinating. And you can see the expression on her face was anything but comfortable. What gives you the right to inflict that onto a woman in that condition? I mean, that is beyond abuse." Despite Lyman's lack of technical training, West was really affected by the films. When West asked Lyman if he could follow a script for a possible TV project, a documentary about communes, Lyman declined, dissing him with an astrological slight. You double cancer! Later, when West screened a rough cut of The Real World for the community, family member David Goode pulled out a gun and said, "You talk about the real world? This is the real world." Undeterred, West showed the pilot to CBS, which declined to pick it up. When West returned to the Hill for his equipment, they refused to give it back. It's one of the incidents that the Fort Hill community claims Rolling Stone fabricated, but even today Don West confirms it happened. The Magic Theater never materialized. Growing impatient, Mel ordered that the unfinished structure be raised. A film studio in Roxbury was not going to be how the family attained mainstream film or television exposure. Miraculously, it seemed, by the time they leveled the Magic Theater, a new path had appeared. A member of the Lyman family was on the cover of Look magazine, promoting his debut starring role in Michelangelo Antonioni's hotly anticipated movie, Zabriskie Point. The nationwide search for a leading man had dragged on for a solid year before finally hitting Boston in the summer of 1968. The stakes were high. Zabriskie Point was going to be Antonioni's first film shot in America. The acclaimed Italian director wanted to tell a story about America's counterculture youth, the very same demographic that was so adept at sniffing out phonies, meaning that the film's authenticity hinged on his choice of the right actor. Antonioni had been shooting compelling, critically praised arthouse movies since the 50s, such as the enigmatic L'Avventura, but his breakthrough was 1966's Blow Up, a hip mystery that captured mod-filled swinging London. The news that this major auteur's next film would be shot in the United States, released by MGM, and star American actors sent a wave of excitement through the counterculture. Sally Dennison, 19, from Framingham, had an inkling that directing might be her calling, but in a pre-film school world she had to figure out her own path. After briefly working for Fred Barzyk on What's Happening, Mr. Silver, she decided to simply seek out her favorite film director. "I'm a pistol," she says. "When I wanted something, I went after it." Dennison flew to Rome and asked where the film people hung out. A day later, she was sitting in the same cafe as Michelangelo Antonioni, like Alan Trustman mailing his script to Hitchcock's office and getting a reply. Dennison had taken a blind leap and found a soft landing. She passed along a note saying she'd love to work with him, and he immediately hired her to be part of his American adventure. A few months later, Dennison was scouring the United States for the angry young man who could manifest the director's dark American vision. She visited city after city, interviewing hundreds of hopefuls. In Los Angeles, casting director Fred Roos found someone on the money perfect for the role, an unknown carpenter named Harrison Ford. Antonioni wasn't impressed by the future Star Wars actor, but it wasn't because he was inexperienced. Like many European directors, Antonioni felt he could get a performance out of anyone, Roos explained. The search continued. Dennison returned to her home base in June 1968, where she connected with Avatar contributor Ed Beardsley, who gave her names of promising locals, including himself. The area scene was enthralled by the project. A reporter for the Boston Free Press badgered her for details as she held auditions at Arlington Street Church. "All I can say is that it's a story about American contemporary youth," she offered. "Question. What kind of a lead is it to be?" "Answer. It has to be a young man who's involved with what's going on." "Question. How long do you think it's going to take you to get the movie started?" "Answer. I don't know. We're mystified. We're very mystified. We can't find this boy. We know he must exist." Cruising through Boston in an MGM limo after another unsuccessful round of auditions, Dennison spotted a situation unfolding at a bus stop. A sailor and his girlfriend were fighting. But it was the guy watching them fight who caught Dennison's eye. The tall, good-looking, intense young man was taking it all in, seeming anxious and impatient, when someone in an apartment above the scene, fed up with the bickering, threw a potted plant toward the bus stop. Dennison told the driver to stop as pandemonium ensued. The young man looked up at the plant-launching culprit, shook his fist, and hollered a rage-filled string of obscenities. In his moment of uncontrolled anger, he embodied the same rebel spirit that made James Dean so magnetic. Dennison's colleague, producer Harrison Starr, grabbed him from behind and asked, "How old are you?" 20, he answered, as he was escorted into the limo. Dennison was amazed. Their missing puzzle piece had fallen into place as swiftly as a flower pot tossed from a window. Starr raved over the two clinching attributes of their new find. He's 20, and he hates. Mark Frechette had just been cast as the lead in Zabriskie Point. Raised in Fairfield, Connecticut, Frechette started rebelling in his teens, getting booted from over a dozen schools. He was 18 the first time his name made the papers, in the police blotter for a breach of peace charge. When a Zabriskie Point employee somehow got hold of his medical records, they learned he had been placed in mental institutions twice. The psychiatric evaluation detailed a troubled childhood, distorted religious views, and a deep distaste for authority, advising that he be approached with caution. The information was never passed along to Antonioni. He wasn't equipped to handle the life he came into, Harrison Starr said in hindsight. I did the best I could to help him, but Mark had his destiny. It couldn't have been changed. Frechette married at 17, had a child, and moved to Roxbury, Massachusetts in 1966. I was a self-respecting hippie dropout bum, he told Rolling Stone's David Felton. Then I started reading The Avatar, and it changed my life. Faith Goode, one of the most influential women in the Fort Hill community, had spotted Mark while selling avatars. She was so bowled over by his good looks that she put an issue of the paper into his hands. He didn't know anyone from the community personally at that point, but had made a practice of walking around the park surrounding the Kachituate standpipe in the middle of the night when his child couldn't sleep. With his kid strapped to his back, Frechette would think about what he'd read in Avatar. Mel really made me see what a fool I'd been. It made me grateful that the hill was there, that Mel was there. Frechette had made some unsuccessful attempts to speak with Mel, but after being cast in the film, he was granted an audience. Lyman told Frechette that he could be the instrument that brought Avatar to Hollywood, and the young actor agreed. A week earlier, Frechette had been panhandling in Harvard Square, in between carpentry jobs. Now he had been chosen as uniquely special by two controversial artists. In late August 1968, armed with a complete run of avatars in his suitcase, Mark Frechette set out for California. Zabriskie Point's titular locale is a lookout spot in Death Valley National Park, its name an homage to a mining operation once headquartered nearby. The feeling of space and time reminds me of the moon, Antonioni told the press. And the hills look as if no man has ever walked over them. It later provided the backdrop to some of the Tatooine scenes in Star Wars, and the cover of U2's The Joshua Tree. Rumors were circulating that the film would feature anti-American themes. The New York Times reported that the movie's executive producer flatly denied that the troupe had filmed scenes in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, where Robert F. Kennedy had been killed just months before. We were all followed and tracked by the FBI, Sally Dennison recalls. Everyone was sure we were making a radical film. It made me very paranoid, I must say. The American film crew often referred to Antonioni as a pinko dago pornographer. For the film's opening, a faux documentary glimpse into a meeting of activist students, Antonioni cast Kathleen Cleaver, a high-ranking member of the Black Panthers, to deliver the dialogue. The FBI was actively trying to dismantle the Panthers, and her inclusion either initiated or magnified surveillance of the movie. When asked what the film was about, Antonioni would offer something like, "America is my true protagonist." Look magazine declared, "MGM still claims it doesn't know what Zabriskie Point is all about." The real problem was, neither did Antonioni. The production was about to encounter a series of hurdles, but Antonioni's choice of leading man would become his most reliable headache. That's not to say Antonioni didn't like Frechette. He was by all accounts quite fond of him, even as he resisted the movie he was starring in. "There is something mystical about him," Antonioni mused to the New York Times. The two leads, Daria Halperin and Frechette, met for the first time in August on set in Los Angeles, where Antonioni filmed the opening sequences. Halperin had been cast after Antonioni watched Jack O'Connell's Revolution, a documentary about Haight-Ashbury. She appears at the end, nude, 19, and beautiful. Mark was sitting there in his big armchair looking like a zombie, not saying a word to anyone. Real white and pasty, Halperin recalled. And he's got these huge Benjamin Franklin glasses on. "Are you wearing a wig?" Mark flatly asked Daria. Their chemistry was natural. The two began an affair during production. Still, both leads were shy, inexperienced, and needed prodding. "Turn and grab Mark as if you really wanted him," Antonioni instructed Daria. "Oh, Michelangelo," Daria chided. "You Italian pervert." Look, one of many media outlets that dispatched a journalist to the set, reported that Antonioni was drawn to Daria's bratty, free, earth-child quality, and believed Mark had the elegance of an aristocrat, though from a poor family. The Times' coverage bordered on fanatical, reporting on the film at length before and after its release, hailing the inexperienced Frechette as this year's James Dean. Frechette wasn't impressed or fazed by the press coverage. He was just trying to figure out the best way to promote the Fort Hill community. Press agent Beverly Walker recalled that Frechette brought copies of Avatar to the producer, the director, the reactionary Southern crew, and always to every journalist that visited the set, tirelessly explaining over and over again the importance of nonviolence. Everyone indulged him. "Oh, this is very interesting." After all, he was the star. In mid-September 1968, as Antonioni was moving the 70-person crew from downtown L.A. to Death Valley, Frechette left the set for what would be the first of several unscheduled breaks from making Zabriskie Point. Mel had announced that the Aquarian Age was about to begin, on the date of a particular astrological configuration that most others didn't interpret that way, Lyman follower Michael Kindman recalled. It was time to come home. Members of the community returned to Roxbury from all over the country, watching the sun rise on Fort Hill together, certain the new age had commenced. Frechette, emerging as an important member of Lyman's inner circle, was more excited about the events of his visit home than he had been by any of the movie-making process. "That was the first time I heard Mel's music," Frechette explained. "We stayed up and smoked some of his fantastic weed and listened to his music. All the music he ever recorded he played for me that weekend." Frechette reluctantly departed for Death Valley with a stack of Mel's tape reels, hopeful that Antonioni might consider it for the soundtrack. "It's hard to say what he thought of them," Mark told Rolling Stone. "I noticed that during one of the more spirited pieces he was twitching in his chair quite a bit." The soundtrack, featuring Pink Floyd and John Fahey, was one of the strongest features of the finished film. but it did not feature the music of Mel Lyman. After this failure, Frechette tried sneaking issues of Avatar into shots, setting it up so Lyman's image would be visible in the frame. Each time, an incensed Antonioni spotted the planted image and chucked it. Meanwhile, Daria Halprin was falling head over heels for Frechette, and she was far more receptive to his stories about his community back home. After 8 or 9 months of my ranting and raving, Daria had a vision, Frechette said. She saw the face of Melvin. She must have recognized it from the Avatar cover since she'd never met him before. A few days later, she made her decision for Mel and agreed, once the movie was finished, to live with her co-star on Fort Hill. For Mark, scoring a successful conversion revealed how little was being included in Antonioni's portrait of revolutionary America. Frechette's Fort Hill family believed the revolution was spiritual. Here, the Italian director was filming a surface-level political revolution. In protest, the leading man flew back to Boston, refusing to continue working on the film. It was going to be impossible now, Frechette figured, for Antonioni to continue to ignore the Fort Hill community. The whole thing was a big Hollywood lie. It wasn't real, Frechette told Lyman. So I put a stop to it. I quit. Antonioni's American film debut now held hostage by its own lead, he finally agreed to two of his star's demands. Frechette could re-record some of the dialogue to tone down the political nature of his character, and after completion of the film, Antonioni would spend 10 days at Fort Hill. Back in California, 5 months behind schedule, Zabriskie Point's production team was heading toward a literal blow-up. A culminating scene in which a house in the desert explodes, sending the residue of American culture into the air. No one knew how high and wide debris might be flung, recalled Walker. Local airports were keeping planes away. In gorgeous slow motion, set against a haunting Pink Floyd track, refrigerators, rotisserie chickens, a cucumber, a box of Special K, onions, apples, beer bottles, a newspaper, and hundreds of books launch into a perfect blue sky, then fall to the ground. The film was finally finished. With Zabriskie Point wrapped, Mark and Daria drove east across the United States to their new home in Fort Hill. As the Globe would put it in 1970, no plastic living beside the Hollywood pools for them. Frechette and Miss Halprin are members of the community of 100 or so men, women, and children on the Roxbury Hilltop. A somewhat utopian group is headed by 31-year-old Mel Lyman and is a completely cooperative community. Miss Halprin, a West Coast girl, has been at Fort Hill since last April. Yes, I will make more films if that is what I am expected to do. I will do it for Mel. I'll do anything to serve my purpose of living. Asked what that was, she replied quietly, Mel. To serve Mel. Three different MGM presidents had been involved with Zabriskie Point by the time it was released. There was talk that the company was about to go belly up or be sold off. In February 1970, when the troubled production finally arrived in theaters, a man named James Aubrey headed MGM. To Antonioni's face, Aubrey called Zabriskie Point a masterpiece. But privately, he was deeply worried. MGM was in for $7 million. He needed the picture to succeed, and the finished project smelled like disaster. In desperation, he decided that the silent ending in which Daria drives into the sunset alone after the explosion was too bleak. What if she rode out to an uplifting song to convince audiences that they had not just been taken for a pointless dour ride? He tapped his young protege, Michael Kerb, to write a tune with Roy Orbison and sneak it into the final print without Antonioni's knowledge. Kerb, the new president of MGM Records, a role in which he would trash the Bosstown sound and purge the label's drug acts, also wrote the liner notes for the soundtrack. If seeing is believing, then experiencing is being, he incoherently declares. The finished film has only a slightly clearer message. Unsurprisingly, almost no one cared for Zabriskie Point. Journalists jumped at the chance to explain how a genius director from Italy got America wrong. Vincent Canby in the New York Times called it one of his most ambiguous and least profound films. As a dramatization of what he sees as a contemporary American state of mind, it is both superficial and overly intellectualized. Richard Goldstein wrote that the film is far more interesting to me as a failure than Blow Up was as a success, imagining the director traveling the country, meeting real black people and politely asking where the next race riot was being held. Local music magazine Broadside noted its beauty, then lamented, "Too bad the medium isn't the message." The director has seriously misread America. Nevertheless, the film made its two plucked-from-obscurity leads semi-famous, landing them on the cover of Rolling Stone. The press tour kicked off a month after the film's release. If the couple were not ready to star in a major motion picture, they were spectacularly ill-equipped to execute a press tour. In nearly every interview, the leads disparaged the movie and/or its director. The Rolling Stone cover story called the movie seriously flawed, but of exceptional importance. It was as if this Italian director's failed attempt to capture American youth culture had emboldened that same youth culture with the confidence to say, "Here is what we're not." It lent credence to the idea that the new left movement and hippie revolutionary scene were real, complex, and easily mischaracterized, even by a sympathetic maestro such as Antonioni. As they gave interviews, the young couple already knew that most people regarded the film as a flop, and they agreed. Antonioni didn't represent reality, Frechette told the Globe. It is all surface phenomenon, period piece, part of the prehistoric past. Halperin took it further. The whole movie embarrassed me. Both claimed that Antonioni barely gave them any direction. On the Merv Griffin show, Mark threw a punch at another guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tony Dolan, who had written critically about Avatar in 1968. Perhaps MGM's PR people were pointedly ignoring their stars' interviews, or maybe they perceived Mark and Daria's trash talk as some weird form of anti-marketing. In any case, things reached a new low the following month when the couple appeared on the Dick Cavett Show. After interviewing film critic Rex Reed and director Mel Brooks, Cavett sets the stage. They didn't know each other before the film. They now live together in a commune. The couple walks out, towering and beautiful. The audience applauds. Everything seems pretty standard for a talk show appearance, save for one problem. The actors are barely talking. Cavett prompts Frechette to tell the now infamous bus stop casting story, but he refuses. "I was cast at a bus stop. That's about it." When asked about their living situation, Frechette tells Cavett, "It is a community, but the purpose of the community is not communal living. The community is for one purpose, and that's to serve Mel Lyman." MGM suspended the tour. Mark and Daria resumed their life together in Roxbury. Michelangelo Antonioni never made good on his promise to visit. When Daria moved to Fort Hill with Mark, they were welcomed as commune royalty. Mark loved being one of the Hill workers when he wasn't planning future filmmaking endeavors with Mel or going off to act in a couple of Grade B movies, community member Michael Kindman later recalled. Daria had a harder time fitting in, and was really out of her element. Mel and Jesse named their baby after her, but that didn't help. In September 1970, Mark left to go perform in a movie in Yugoslavia, leaving Daria alone on Fort Hill for the first time. From fairly reliable anonymous sources, we know that life on Fort Hill gradually became very trying for Daria, David Fulton wrote. She may have been too independent for their tastes, but several people have mentioned violent encounters, some physical, between Daria and the Fort Hill women, particularly Jesse. A publicist at MGM recalled to Felton that Daria asked for help getting work in commercials around this time. Her Zabriskie Point earnings had all been ceded to the Fort Hill community, she confessed. When the publicist found a job for her, Daria was ordered back to Fort Hill for retraining. Later, with both Mark and Daria in Los Angeles at the new West Coast Lyman Outpost, Daria left the community and asked Mark to do so as well. He did, but days later, a few community members showed up with an airline ticket to Boston. Frechette accepted the offer, glad that the decision had been made for him. In the end, he chose the Lyman family over Daria Halperin. People on the Hill have to learn to put Melvin and the community ahead of themselves. And she just couldn't do that, Mark later explained. I don't know if she'll ever come back. She didn't. Daria appeared in one more film, 1972's The Jerusalem File. That year she met, married, and had a child with Dennis Hopper, the star, writer, and director of a counterculture film that audiences actually had gone out in droves to see, 1969's Easy Rider. The three men dressed differently. Mark, now 25 and sporting a mustache, wore an olive-green suit and carried a suitcase. Terry was casual in short sleeves, and Herc had on dark sunglasses and a shirt resembling a guard's uniform. He stood at the front door with his hand in a paper bag. Inside was a .38-caliber revolver. The three men had walked a mile to rob the New England Merchants National Bank. This was not something from a new Mark Frechette movie. This was a scene from the real world. At 4:50 p.m. on Wednesday, August 29, 1973, Mark Frechette approached a woman at a desk outside of the teller station and asked her about a loan. She told him she was assisting some other patrons, but her associate could help. Mark told the second bank employee he needed a $2,500 loan. "I've got a steady job," he nervously told her, as he slid a note across the table. It read, "There are three of us. We're going to rob you. Don't get alarmed." She waved a security guard over. Mark revealed his gun and instructed him to place his weapon on the desk. The guard then led Mark and Terry, Fort Hill member Sheldon T. Bernhard, back into the teller's area. "We don't want anyone to get hurt," Mark told the staff. The employee at the loan desk triggered the silent alarm. Each teller station cleaned out their till into Mark's suitcase. The total take was $10,156. The third Hill person, Chris Thien, nicknamed Herc, was in the foyer, disguised as a security guard. Two police officers sped to the location within minutes of the alarm. The first officer, patrolman Daniel Fitzgerald, rushed through the front door and tried to disarm Herc, who managed to throw the officer to the ground. As patrolman Morris Flaherty approached, he spotted his partner on the ground and fired his gun twice, hitting Herc both times. Inside, Mark and Terry watched in horror as their friend fell to the ground. "Put your hands up," the officers screamed, moving into the main area of the bank. Once Terry and Mark were disarmed, two doctors who had witnessed the robbery wanted to attend to Herc, but the police wouldn't allow it. He was carried on a stretcher to nearby Peter Bent Brigham Hospital and pronounced dead on arrival. In committing their act, former FHC member Michael Kindman wrote, they answered a question I had been considering for a long time. Who would be the first to die for, or because of, Mel? Mark and Terry were held at the Charles Street Jail on bail of $2,500, the same dollar amount as the fake loan they had inquired about, which neither could afford. There was a theory that a fourth member of the Fort Hill community had been involved with the robbery. A line of fishing wire had been tied around Herc's leg, and the cops assumed it led to a getaway car whose driver could give a tug if he saw police. "It must have gotten tangled on his leg as we walked over," Frechette offered. Why did they do it? One of the first stories had Frechette telling the police he was evicted from the commune for non-payment of rent the week before he was arrested on the robbery charge. Frechette is never quoted saying this again, but the reason makes sense. Frechette loved Lyman and the community so much, even choosing it over romantic love with Daria Halprin. If the community had evicted their superstar for missed rent, he would have tried anything to get back in. 2 decades later, Beverly Walker told Film Comment that Mark would not cooperate with his own defense because it would have meant turning against Mel Lyman. Another motive appeared in the Globe. "We did it as a revolutionary act of political protest," Frechette claimed. "We had been watching the Watergate hearings on television. We saw the apathy and we felt an intense rage. Because banks are federally insured, robbing that bank was a way of robbing Richard Nixon without hurting anybody. We just reached the point where all that the three of us really wanted to do was hold up a bank. And besides, standing there with a gun cleaning out a teller's cage, that's about as fucking honest as you can get, man." The press was primed to jump on this claim. In August 1973, the nation's biggest political scandal was dominating the news. Co-conspirator Terry Bernhardt still cites this as the motive. "It was a revolutionary act. Money? Yeah, sure, I need some money," he told a documentary filmmaker in 2008. "But I certainly didn't want to rob a bank. I tried to talk them out of it." A final theory appeared 14 years later. In a 1987 issue of Film Cultura, director Deju Magyar recounted that he and Frechette wanted to adapt a part of Crime and Punishment because we felt that America was like a Dostoevsky-type world. Every other day, the actor would call from Boston, saying he almost had the necessary funds. One day he called me and said that he would bring the $5 million the next day. Great. I was watching TV in the evening when it was announced that Mark Frechette attempted to rob a bank at gunpoint and was arrested. It's true that Frechette wanted to adapt Crime and Punishment, but it's hard to believe that he imagined that much money could be waiting for him inside a small Roxbury bank. Not to mention the fact that this was the same branch where the FHC kept its own savings. A week after the facts of the case were reported, an in-depth feature on Mark and the incident appeared in just about every newspaper in town. The Globe even mocked Mel Lyman's signature style in the opening. "Mark Frechette has spent the past week in cell 104, Charles Street Jail. He's had time to reflect on what he's been doing and what he's been neglecting." Additional motives were floated. "The anger was in those boys," Jesse Benton said. "It was real hard for them. We had 16 kids to feed, and we can't buy meat. To me, robbing a bank is like robbing the government. Everybody's money is insured." From inside their cells, Mark and Terry realized that the 60s were long gone. "We haven't changed," Frechette said. "Everybody else is gone. Where did they go?" The Lyman family just didn't seem cut out to handle the changes that the 1970s had in store for society. Much of what Mark was saying seemed oddly out of sync with the decade, Vin McClellan wrote in The Phoenix. Apparently, in the isolation of the Fort Hill community, there still lives a few bits of 1966. For the first time since the negative Rolling Stone expose, local reporters made their way up the hill and into 5 Fort Avenue Terrace. Passing through the Tolkien Hobbit wall built around Mel's house, they were greeted by beautiful women in oddly formal cocktail dresses. In a room dubbed The Connection, a room built to join 2 houses on Fort Avenue Terrace, George Pepper, Jesse Benton, and Faith Goode were ready to explain how their friends had made an honest, rational decision to rob that bank. The Real Paper's Joe Klein, the future Primary Colors author, went up first. Joe, was the bank robbery a way of standing up for the truth? Jesse, we haven't changed, but we've watched as the society around us changed. All the hope for this country is going down the drain with assassination, fizzled revolutionaries. Faith, the motivation for the ripoff was a product of where this country is at. We've sat and watched Watergate week after week, and so in desperation those boys did up front what the government was doing in secret. Joe, but they had guns. Jesse, yes. And the first chamber in each of the guns was empty. There wouldn't have been any violence if that bank teller hadn't pushed that silent alarm and called the cops. To us, the big question is, what was that teller protecting? Was pushing that button worth Chris's life? Faith, it was a way of keeping Watergate alive. They weren't simply three thugs. Joe, what does it mean for your future? Are you going to start knocking off banks now? Jesse, we don't know. We're in great darkness, and we know a change is coming. In the next issue of The Real Paper, Klein published a letter from an ex-community member. Non-material? Asked the critical letter. Why does Mel travel in a Cadillac limousine with TV, telephone, and bar? Why does he own a $15,000 camper and have several wives, not to mention all the stereo equipment, television, swimming pools, and estates in California? Money is tight on the Hill, even for food. But that's because of overexpansion and poor management. Mel was nowhere to be found. He was traveling, they told Klein. They passed along his only message, the hope that Herc hadn't died in vain. Klein proceeded down to the Charles Street jail to check in with Frechette. Before, when I was out on the street, he said, there had been something inside me, something that stopped me from stepping in line, getting in place. I kept landing in jail and fucking up. But you're back in jail now, aren't you? Klein asked. Is it any different now than it was before? It was as if it was the first time in years that someone outside of the Lyman family had finally made a valid point that Frechette could understand. I never asked myself that, he said. That's a hell of a question. In April 1974, Mark Frechette and Sheldon Terry Bernhard pleaded guilty upon recommendation of their lawyer Harvey Silverglate, the same man who helped the community through the Avatar obscenity trials. There was no defense to be mounted. The two men were sentenced to 6 to 15 years. Inside prison, other bank robbers found it hilarious that Terry and Mark had no idea they needed to be out of the building within 2 minutes to successfully pull off the heist. Though it might not have been an actual motive, Mark and Terry were truly obsessed with the Watergate scandal. They call themselves the Stars in Stripes, Tom Snyder told the NBC viewing audience in late March 1975. 15 inmates at the prison colony in Norfolk, Massachusetts, who spent the weekend reenacting the Watergate crimes behind bars. The prisoners performed their version of the White House transcripts, complete with an exact replica of the President's Oval Office. The play was directed by Mark Frechette. Terry, wearing a prosthetic nose, was Nixon. I held up a bank and got 5 to 16, he told a reporter. Nixon held up a country, and he got a pardon. Frechette had hand-selected murderers and thieves from the prison yard to play Watergate figures, such as H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman. I'd love it if Nixon were here tonight, Terry said, especially if he were wearing a blue shirt. The opening night audience included Senator Ted Kennedy and Edward Brooke, the former Massachusetts DA who was involved in both the Strangler and Titicut legal cases. The president and his collaborators were portrayed tonight by convicts, one prisoner told reporter Mike Barnicle. That's gotta shake you. Just a little bit. Then 6 months later, on September 27, 1975, Mark Frechette was found dead in the Norfolk County Prison weight room. A 150-pound barbell was on his neck. He was 27. In the weeks leading up to his death, Frechette had lost weight and sunk into a deep depression. Being in that kind of a place for someone like Mark was absolutely hell, Bernhard recalled. Prison officials had listed him as having questionable stability and scheduled him for an October psychiatric appointment. Was his death a freak accident? Suicide? Foul play? The prison officially ruled the death as the first. Both Silverglate and Beverly Walker suspected the last. We were close to getting out. We would have gotten parole in a couple of months, Bernhard sadly noted in 2008. Mark Frechette's tragic story became a permanent part of Zabriskie Point. It all seemed beyond coincidence, as if his own life were a movie that transformed him from an anonymous carpenter to a famous actor and devotee of Mel Lyman to a criminal acting in jail. With no experience, he was cast by one of the most famous directors in the world based on his everyday behavior. His character was named Mark. He was wanted for murder. On screen and on the streets, he was the confused rebel with a gun. Terry Bernhard, the remaining survivor of the bank robbery, served his term and returned to the Fort Hill community. He played piano on Jim Queskin's 1979 Side by Side album. He still resides with his fellow Hill members, sometimes performing with local jazz trios. The prison where he was initially held after the failed holdup is now a luxury hotel called the Liberty, featuring a bar and nightclub named Alibi and Clink, respectively. It was a good bank robbery, Frechette had told the press from jail. Maybe it wasn't a successful one, but it was real. You know? Chapter 7. I Saw You Coming from the King. It's possible that no one besides Peter Wolf has heard any recording of Van Morrison's various Boston lineups since they toured around New England in the summer of 1968. Even the musicians who made up the Belfast Singers' first steady American live band haven't heard Wolf's bootleg. Wolf himself hasn't listened to his tapes of the Van Morrison controversy performing at the Catacombs in over a decade, as he explained to me while staring at the boxes containing the reels on his bookshelf. After I publish a brief account of meeting with Wolf, conjecture about these Boston tapes bubbles up on assorted online message boards and the pages of Uncut magazine, but no one brags about hearing them. What did the Astral Week song sound like before producer Louis Marenstein's Jazz Ringers got hold of them? Was the album's timeless vibe invented on the spot in the studio? Or was the foundation laid down in Boston? And what did the song sound like before Van had his Midsummer Night's Dream about getting rid of electric instruments? Online, the bottom of an old Boston Tea Party poster for a series of 1968 shows catches my eye. The Van Morrison controversy and the Road Light Show can be seen on WGBH-TV Wednesday, May 29th, 7:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. Could audio and video of a Boston lineup be moldering in the basements of WGBH? David Atwood, who directed WGBH's Mixed Bag, a half-hour show presenting local rock and jazz bands, is the man who would know. A natural archivist, Atwood has a home collection of tapes of his directorial work, and a pocket calendar detailing what he did every day at WGBH. Consulting his notes, he confirms that the show aired that night. My hopes start to soar, even after he tells me that the episode is not in his personal archive, but might be in WGBH's. A few days later, bad news. This episode is nowhere to be found. In 2016, the rest of Van's Boston players emerge from the woodwork, eager to talk. One of them is drummer Joey Bebo, who multiple sources claimed was deceased. Over a plate of nachos, Bebo jokes that for all this time he thought they had all disappeared. Now retired from his job as a computer programmer, he's become a prolific writer of what he calls techno-thrillers. In one, a scientist discovers a powerful telescope, then goes missing. Plot twists ensue. By the time he's rescued, he's invented a ray to look back into the past. Bebo arrived from Plattsburgh, New York, to attend the Berklee School of Music in 1966. In the early spring of 1968, one of his classmates, bassist Tom Kilbanya, invited him to audition for Morrison. Bebo wasn't thrilled at first, dismissing Them's Gloria as teeny bopper stuff. But he was in no position to turn down a paid job. His parents had caught wind of his penchant for pot, and he felt the pressure of supporting himself. If it wasn't jazz or serious soul, I just wasn't interested, Bebo recalls. I was about to work with one of the best songwriters and singers of all time, and I didn't have a clue. En route to guitarist John Sheldon's home off Harvard Square, Bebo and Kilbanya got stoned out of their skulls. The sideburned Bebo looked like a pirate, in purple shirt and bell-bottoms. Sheldon gave off the vibe of a preppy vampire in his red blazer. Kilbanya had stringy hair, dark shades, and frumpy clothes. Van sat silently in the corner. When it was time to play, they ripped into Gloria, Bebo keeping his eyes on Van, looking for tempo and dynamics. Next up in the audition, brown-eyed girl featuring an aggressive rock guitar line, Bebo says, like Jimi Hendrix meets Bob Marley. Bebo got the job. The band learned more than 24 songs for their summer tour. In the weeks leading up to the first show, there were backyard games of frisbee and lunches in Harvard Square. But even during breaks, it was difficult to get Morrison talking. The only time you could get definitive opinions out of the singer was by asking him about other performers. Tom Kilbanya would mention another band, and Morrison would usually sum them up as those faggots. The trash talk would flow freely after Morrison had a few drinks. Bebo remembered Van saying that he couldn't smoke dope due to burning my brain on hash when I was younger. Janet Planet concurred with this assessment. He was absolutely drinking back then. Alcohol is definitely his drug of choice. He doesn't need anything to expand his mind any further. He needs the downer, the closer offer. Bebo says Morrison drank heavily before taking the stage, every single show. I had never been in a group that did everything together like this before, Bebo says. Most of my career, I simply showed up for work with my drums, and that was the extent of it. Van's band was different. Another difference was the pay. Bebo got $150 a week for rehearsal and $150 per show, no matter what the end-of-night payout was. Kilbanya recalls it as being $50. Morrison also employed 2 roadies for each performance. For Bebo, who had recently visited Van and Janet's less-than-palatial Cambridge digs, this was a confusingly large sum. Where was it all coming from? Eventually, he pieced together that Morrison already had financial backers by the start of summer. According to Janet Planet, a Boston-based music manager named Richard asked Van to move to the city, play some gigs, and be managed by him. He was not affiliated with the company at all, she says. It turned out he was not an effective manager, although he certainly got us out of a tight spot in New York. But Morrison jettisoned Richard after realizing he was a complete wacko, who told at least one band member that he was associated with the Cosa Nostra. Kilbane says a man named Frank booked all of Morrison's New England concerts that summer. Regardless of who was funding the touring or how much money exactly was behind it, many elements of it remained shoestring. The band crammed into a junky van to drive out of the city for their first show together at the Rainbow Ballroom and Roller Dome in Hyannisport on Cape Cod.